100 Years War Historical Podcast, Episode 1, Series 1. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single iron fist. In the fertile and populous land of Flanders in 1340, Edward III, one of the great warrior kings of English history, unveils a flag including the English lions, then referred to as leopards, of his own kingdom, and the fleur-de-lis of the French crown. At the unveiling of this flag, Edward said, "I will cross the sea, my subjects with me, and I'll pass through the Cambresis. I will set the country ablaze, and there I will await my mortal enemy, Philip of Valois, who wears the fleur-de-lis. I will fight him, even if I have only 1 man to his 10. Does he believe he can take my land from me? I once paid him homage, which confounds me now. I was young, and that is not worth 2 ears of corn. I swear to him as king by St. George, and sank the knee that neither you nor noble ever exacted such tribute in France as I intend to do." Actually, it's very unlikely Edward said anything of the sort. This is an extract from a poem of an anonymous author called The Vow of the Heron. However, the action by Edward was an act of theatre, playing to the English in an attempt to sustain a war with France that had already dragged on for 3 years and had achieved nothing that the English could see but racking up a huge bill and resulting in terrifying raids along the English coast. This power struggle between two of the great kingdoms of Western Europe would result in nearly constant warfare for more than 100 years. This war would inflict unimaginable suffering and terror upon hundreds of thousands of people who would be born and die only knowing a state of constant warfare and coming to believe that this is normal and perhaps even right. As is almost always the case, the ravages of warfare will be outdone many times over by the horrors of disease. The pressures of both will bring these countries close to complete social disintegration. But it'll also play its part in the inevitable progress of time, bringing to an end the inherently brutal system of feudalism and introducing the beginnings of the Renaissance that will lead to a new style of government that we would begin to recognize as a modern state. In this podcast, I set out to tell this remarkable and terrible story, but I'm going to tell it as a story and not a piece of pure history. I'll be drawing on the work of historians who have done the hard work of original source research, and I'll distill it down to what I think is important and interesting. And in doing so, hope to relate a long and complex story in a way that maintains the drama, passion, intrigue, horror, and romance that drew me to this story in the first place. For the purposes of telling the story, I plan to choose a truth and present as if it is true, rather than dwelling on all the uncertainties and all the other possible truths that are always part of historical stories. It seems to me remarkable how much we do know about the late Middle Ages, and then equally remarkable how little we know about important people and important events during this period. If we want to know how many longbow arrows Henry V of England commissioned from a certain part of England, we can pin this down almost to an exact number and day. If, on the other hand, we want to know Henry's mind when he demanded the execution of his dearest friend, colleague, and quite possibly his lover, Lord Scrope, we have no idea. Part of the problem is that kings tended to think it was an excellent idea to record in detail day-to-day bureaucratic matters. But when it came to the big decisions of state and warfare, it was considered hard enough to keep this a secret without writing the thing down. So a lot of what we draw on to determine decision-making and motivation is what the person does, what other people around them do, and what others, usually enemies or allies, do in response. The other difficulty with historical truth is this is always filtered not just through the writer of that truth, but also the writer's audience. So this podcast will be another case of filtering through my own values and prejudices. But if you stay with me, you will learn a version of this extraordinary series of events, which is going to be as valid as I can make it. I must warn the listener, however, that if a particular piece of rumor or scandal is just too juicy to ignore, then it's going in, and I'll let you decide if you believe it or not. The story of the Hundred Years' War still has resonance today in how many French and English people perceive themselves as a nation and a people. While it is only a small percentage of people who consider the calling on the memory of and seemingly endless refighting of Agincourt is a justification for soccer hooliganism, many more consider the longbowmen of England as evidence of that plucky English spirit, and across the Channel as recently as last century, the French might describe England as the traditional enemy. There is also continuing religious resonance coming from the time, in the form of Joan of Arc, who is still one of the patron saints of France. I lit a candle to St. Joan when I visited one of her many statues, this one being in the beautiful Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Why an atheist like me was undertaking such a religious ritual is not easy to explain, but I've been touched by the beauty of her story, and respect the place it plays in promoting peace and charity, rather than the strife and warfare that was so much a part of her life. Perhaps the beauty and magnificence of the environment of that grand cathedral brought out in me a scrap of spiritualism that I would rather not accept is there. One of the difficulties in telling the story of the Hundred Years' War is that it never happened. That is, there was never such a thing as the Hundred Years' War. Rather, there was a period of intense rivalry and warfare between the kingdoms of France and England that dominated the political landscape of Western Europe for more than 100 years. It was much later that these series of events became identified with a catch-all title. But it is useful to give things a name and a parameter that would have seemed nonsensical at the time, for the sake of identification and simplicity, which is just as well, because otherwise my podcast would have finished in the same episode it started. I'm going to begin with the story of why Edward III had a claim on the crown of France, and how it is that the people of England could rally behind this new royal banner, seeing his claim as justified and right and worthy of their support, both in terms of taxation and manpower. The family trees of the nobility of Western Europe were typically close and intertwined, and if you weren't going to marry a cousin, albeit somewhat removed, then you probably were not going to marry anybody of a status equal to your own. You also did not usually have to go far back in one of these noble lineages before things get more and more fanciful. As often as not, including such distinguished people as water nymphs or ancient heroes, giving them a rather Greek myth feel. So without too much bending and twisting, one noble could usually find reason to claim at least some of the titles of another within almost any of the kingdoms of Western Europe. However, Edward's claim was much stronger than that. And perhaps it was stronger than Philip VI, who was sitting on the soon-to-be decidedly insecure throne of France. To explain this, we'll need to have a look at the nature of feudalism and kingship at the time of the Hundred Years' War, and also some of the legal processes that were a part of this relationship. We also need to understand what has been happening between England and Scotland, and the role France has played in this relationship. But to get things started, I want to explain why Edward III is both the King of England and a Duke and Count beholden to the King of France. To do this, I'm going back to the story of the most remarkable Eleanor of Aquitaine. Eleanor is one hell of a woman. She'll be married to 2 kings and give birth to 2 more, and become an effective and successful ruler and administrator in her own right. She'll play a part in inspiring a crusade and eventually scandalize the courts of Europe and the people of France and England in equal measure. She will be described as an Amazon warrior of God and the whore of Babylon. And in the end, she would leave a political instability between the kingdoms of France and England that was a time bomb with a 200-year delay. And it just needed a man as proud, stubborn, and headstrong as Edward to set it off. While I will focus on the aspects of Eleanor's story that is relevant to the cause of the Hundred Years' War, I encourage any history fan to learn more about Eleanor, as this is one of the great stories coming out of the Middle Ages in Western Europe. And while she would have been considered remarkable, scandalous, and successful in today's world, to be so powerful, free-spirited, and well-educated within the misogynistic world of feudal Western Europe would seem completely fanciful if it didn't really happen. So any woman who can be so annoying that both her royal husbands end up arresting her at some stage gets my respect straight away. Eleanor was born in 1124 to William X of Aquitaine and Eleanor de Châtellerault. She was raised in a court more respectful of the rights and roles of noble women than was common at that time. It was a court that promoted diversity, education, and the arts, making it a more interesting and informative place than most of what she was to find after her childhood. This included a significant exposure to the arts of troubadours and very early promotions of the concept of courtly love. And perhaps these romantic stories of pure and unrequited, and sometimes not at all pure and distinctly requited love, between a noble lady and the adoring young men of her court, shaped her expectations of romance and influenced her expectations of marriage and courtly life in her youthful years. Her father, William, died on a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela on the west coast of Spain when she was only 13, leaving her the eldest of two surviving daughters. She carried the titles of Count of Poitou and Duke of Aquitaine as an inheritance right that will pass in part to the man she married. Interestingly, William X set up a legal mechanism whereby Eleanor would maintain some authority over the lands of Aquitaine and Poitou, and full authority would then pass to her children at the point that her eldest son takes control. It needs to be noted that the lands that Eleanor notionally controlled were larger than those controlled by the King of France at that time, and they were abundant and productive lands, including critical trade such as, and not surprisingly, in fine wine. In his last days, William arranged for Eleanor to marry the Dauphin, Louis, the heir apparent to the French crown. A month after her marriage to Louis the Younger, she found herself the Queen of France, and Louis found himself both the king and the indirect ruler of the Duchy of Aquitaine. They were both very young and impetuous, but here the similarities ended. Louis was not expected to be king until the death of his elder brother, and had until then lived an ecclesiastic lifestyle. He was reserved, pious, and had been taught that it was women's sexuality that had caused most of the misery in the world, and with this came sexual inhibition. Eleanor, on the other hand, was strong-willed, free-spirited, and for the age, very sexually liberated. The early years of Louis's reign were a disaster, pretty much as you might expect putting two teenagers in charge of a country. Then, in 1145, Europe was shocked by the fall of the Christian state of Edessa to a Turkish Muslim army. This event put the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem itself at risk. A speech by Bernard of Clairvaux at Vézelay seems to have ignited a passion for crusade in France, which swept up the naturally pious Louis. and there was no way Eleanor was going to miss out on an exciting adventure like this. 3,000 miles later, hardship, blazing heat, bitter cold, rancid food, and near-death experiences had taken a lot of the gloss off this particular adventure. After being partially overrun by a Turkish army, King Louis and Eleanor made the last of the trip to Antioch by boat, leaving what was left of the French army to make its way by foot. It is upon arriving in Antioch that Louis's awful crusade becomes even worse. The ruler of Antioch was Eleanor's uncle, Raymond. Raymond was reputedly good-looking, energetic, educated, and cultured, with a significant amount of Eastern mystique. All of these things would have made him interesting to Eleanor, and as the senior living male in her family, he was also a natural father figure. Raymond had particular goals in mind for what was left of the French crusade, and hoped that Eleanor could influence Louis towards the same goals. Eleanor clearly enjoyed Raymond's company and spent a lot of time with him, while her experiences of the crusade with Louis seems to have caused Eleanor to become increasingly distant from her husband. Louis had no interest in the plans of Raymond, and in his mind the crusade had moved from a military undertaking to more of a personal pilgrimage to Jerusalem. This lack of concern for Raymond's situation and move towards an increasingly introspective and pious crusade may have further alienated Eleanor from him. This got so bad that when Louis announced that he was leaving for Jerusalem, Eleanor informed him that she was staying with Raymond in Antioch. Louis was appalled that Eleanor was so blatantly disregarding what would commonly have been seen as the role of a wife and queen, and was heartbroken when Eleanor informed him that she wanted an annulment to their marriage. In response, Louis bundled Eleanor up in the middle of the night and snuck her out of Antioch, and thus she joined him on his pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and then another harrowing sea journey, eventually ending up back in France. The incident in Antioch resulted in serious accusations against Eleanor of breaching her responsibilities as a wife and induced rumours of a sexual relationship between her and her uncle, Raymond. There were other rumours in the French court of a sexual relationship between Eleanor and a senior French knight in the Crusade. But neither of these come up as issues for Louis or his inner court at the time, and therefore it seems unlikely to be true. However, the break with Louis was very much true, and Eleanor had lost her influence over the king and a significant role in determining state policy. Despite intervention by the then Pope to save their marriage, Eleanor had another daughter to Louis, and this was the end of any hope for their relationship. And Louis consented to Eleanor's continuing requests to seek an annulment. There were common beliefs at the time that if a woman had previously had daughters, then she would be inclined to continue to have daughters. There was also a prevalent belief that to have a son required passion in the relationship, and that if this is gone, then the couple may be even more likely to only have daughters. While these things would have played a part in Louis's decision, he was giving up a great deal in terms of power and influence for the crown, both now and going into the future. By losing his direct and hereditary connection to the Duchy of Aquitaine, perhaps he hoped to maintain enough control over Eleanor to finally take control of those lands through the hereditary entitlements of his daughters. But it seems that he continued to love Eleanor and ultimately decided to do what would make her happy. Eleanor first met the young Duke of Normandy, Henry Plantagenet, in 1151. He was youthful and vigorous, charming and courteous. He was also unusually well educated for a French noble of that period. He was known to have moments of recklessness supported by seemingly endless courage, which gave him a rather bold and somewhat dangerous persona, which may also have been hard to resist. Henry was in line to inherit significant lands in France and had a strong claim to be the next in line for the English crown. Eleanor's obvious affection for Henry may have been another factor that finally brought Louis to decide to push to annul their marriage. The claim to finish their marriage was based on consanguinity. This is a church principle based on the idea that a marriage cannot be deemed to have occurred in the first place if the couple are found to be too close as family relations. The technical requirement was that a couple could not have a shared ancestor within 7 generations. The nature of royal intermarriage in Western Europe throughout the Middle Ages was such that it was rarely a problem to show this family connection. However, the papacy was demonstrating a greater reluctance to improve an annulment of marriage based on consanguinity, unless the connection was significantly closer than that. Louis used his own bishops in France to investigate the matter and to put a finding to the Pope, and the Pope finally consented to, albeit reluctantly. With her marriage over, Eleanor quickly packed up and undertook to return to her lands in Aquitaine. This was an astonishingly dangerous journey, given that any French noble who was able to abduct her and force her into marriage could secure for themselves a large part of France. And in fact, on that journey, there were 2 attempts by different French nobles to do just that. And had Eleanor not provided for herself a significant escort, she may have found herself the wife of someone other than Henry. She married Henry very quickly in a distinctly small and unglamorous ceremony. Well aware that King Louis was likely to be very unhappy with this outcome, but also aware that without the marriage in place, she was going to remain in an uncertain and perilous circumstance. Louis was indeed aggrieved by what happened. 1, because as a noble sworn to Louis in fealty, she should have sought Louis's permission for the marriage, as should have Henry. And secondly, Henry was already a power threat to Louis, and adding Aquitaine and Poitou to his dominions only made the situation worse. Initially, Louis resisted losing his at least notional authority over Poitou and Aquitaine, but in 1154 he settled with Henry and renounced his titles as the Duke of Aquitaine and the Count of Poitou. Henry was now the Duke of Normandy and the Count of Anjou, and his wife Eleanor was the Duchess of Aquitaine and the Countess of Poitou. In the same year of 1154, the King of England, Stephen of Blois, died. Stephen had been engaged in a long-running civil war over the English crown, which was also contested by Henry's mother, the Empress Matilda. With the death of Stephen, Henry immediately pursued his claim for the crown and arrived in England with the small force that he was able to put together at such short notice. However, England was weary of war, and Henry was already known to be a successful warrior and skillful administrator, and so Henry was acknowledged as Henry II, King of England. With remarkably little resistance from the English nobility. This created an inherently unstable situation where the King of England is also the Duke and Count of major lands in France, and through those positions owes fealty to the King of France. It also means that the King of England owns significant lands to both north and south of the lands of the King of France, thus presenting a significant military threat and containing the French king from expansion and consolidating his own lands. Louis almost immediately started to press land claims against Henry, where there were uncertain or contested boundaries. looking to establish his authority and to start to pull back some of what he perceived to be the threat that Henry presented. This resulted in regular conflict between Henry and Louis, and then between Henry and Louis's son, Philip II. Henry spent a lot of his time in France, protecting his interests and using England as a bank to fund his military campaigns. This sets the pattern for conflict between the French Capetian dynasty and the Angevin dynasty of the Plantagenets that will take us right up to the beginnings of the Hundred Years' War. Eleanor quickly started having children for Henry, including 5 sons and 3 daughters. As the Queen of England, Eleanor played a major role in the administration of the state while Henry was on his many campaigns in France. And eventually returning to Poitou in 1168 to take direct control as the Countess. While in France, she nurtured her son's claims to power, and in particular her son Richard, and his claim to the Duchy of Aquitaine. Henry was reluctant to hand significant power over to his young sons, and Eleanor ended up joining her sons in an armed rebellion against Henry. This presented a serious threat to his crown, and it was only through a swift and skillful military response that Henry was able to suppress the rebellion. At the conclusion of the rebellion, Henry conceded some titles and lands to his sons, albeit modest, but offered Eleanor no such forgiveness. He held Eleanor in what we would think of today as house arrest until his death in 1189. Eleanor and Henry's first son died as a child, and their second son died as a young man before he could take the crown. So it was their third son, Richard, always Eleanor's favourite, who became the King of England. Richard went on to be known to history as Richard the Lionheart, famed for his role in the Third Crusade. Their next living son, John Lackland, became king after Richard's death, while, not surprisingly, fighting in France. It was as the Dowager Queen after Henry's death that Eleanor was able to effect significant administrative authority independent of a husband. She used her power skillfully to support the authority and property of first King Richard and then King John. She died at the age of 80, which was extraordinarily long-lived for a person, even a noble person of that period. Despite Eleanor's extraordinary achievements, she was often best remembered as a scandalous woman, subject to many different rumours about her infidelity and promiscuity. I've mentioned the stories about her and her uncle, and other stories of sexual relationships during her time on the Second Crusade. But she was also rumoured to have slept with Henry's father before she started sleeping with Henry. On a rather dark note, it was also rumoured that Henry's father raped her before she married Henry. Certainly, the most romantic story was that she fell in love with the great Muslim ruler Saladin whilst on crusade, writing to him of her love and trying to organise for herself to be taken away by him to become his bride. These stories may have come from a sense of betrayal by the French in her ending up the Queen of England, and in becoming, albeit indirectly, a source of instability and warfare between the kingdoms of France and England. However, I feel that warfare was perceived as a norm of that time, and that the real source of the stories was to show how evil and depraved a woman was who sought to resist the role that God and nature deemed appropriate for her, and who sought power and authority through and ultimately independent of the men in her life. In my next podcast, I'll be looking in more detail at feudal relationships at the beginning of the Hundred Years' War, and the stresses and complications that these created for the kings of France and England. I'll also be looking at the tensions between Scotland and England, and the role this plays in bringing the crowns of France and England closer to war. Finally, I'll begin a consideration of faith and the notion of chivalry that will ultimately underpin how this war plays out. This is the Hundred Years' War, man, signing out for now.